I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, a side effect of foreclosures, squatters. But first, President Bush was not open and forthright on Iraq and relied on propaganda to sell the war. These charges come from former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan, who's been by the president's side since Bush's Texas days and was considered a loyal White House insider. He resigned 2 years ago. McClellan's new memoir is titled What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. Mike Allen, chief political correspondent for Politico, broke this story yesterday. So, Mike, you've read the book. Let's get to the nub of it. Does McClellan say the president lied to go to war?
He doesn't. But, Robin, he says that the president relied on selling the nation through propaganda rather than being more candid with people. So I think there's a distinction there. What Scott writes isn't mean-spirited, but it is extremely damaging. As you know, he's literally a part of the Bush political family. He came with the president from Texas, where he'd worked in the governor's office. He was one of the very few aides to ride with the president on his plane all through the 2000 campaign. And so for him to now say that the president is genuine and sincere and yet veered way off track, was not the leader that he thought he was, is very shocking, and people inside feel personally betrayed.
What were some of the other explosive statements from Scott McClellan? We know he said President Bush took a permanent campaign approach to governing, but he also spoke about the leak of CIA agent Valerie Plame's name after her husband discounted theories of WMDs in Iraq in the run-up to the war. He says he was misled by Karl Rove and Scooter Libby as to their role, which was ultimately revealed they had a role in the leak. But does he say that they lied to him about their role?
Scott says that he was at best misled. He leaves the clear impression that he thinks that they were not honest with him. And he's clearly bitter about the fact that he was then asked to go out and use up his credibility on the podium defending them. And no one thought that Scott McClellan, of all people, one of the most on-message, robotic people in the White House, would write what amounts to a cover-to-cover indictment. And that's part of why Karl Rove and others say that they don't recognize the person who wrote this book. Karl even said that Scott sounds like a left-wing blogger. And what's funny, Robin, is that he does indeed adopt a lot of the rhetoric and ideas of the president's left-wing critics, including maybe the most surprising point in the book, that the White House press corps was too deferential to the administration in the run-up to the war, was too easy on them, didn't ask tough enough questions.
But isn't that a tough place for Scott McClellan to be in, because he apparently didn't either?
No, I think that that's very well put. And Scott is being criticized for not raising these points inside at the time, but that wasn't his job. He was their spokesperson. And now they're saying that he's out of the loop, but he should have been in the loop if he was going to go out and make an effective case for them. And so I think that you have to admire Scott for taking off his flax hat, putting on his historian's hat, giving an account that a lot of people disagree with, but that he clearly thinks is the right thing to do. In the White House now, there's even a very cruel joke. The title, as you said, is What Happened? And they're saying it should be What Happened? With a question mark after it.
He says history appears poised to confirm what most Americans today have decided, that the decision to invade Iraq was a serious strategic blunder. Is that also going to be part of the problem with this book? I'm just wondering, Mike, how it's resonating, because, in fact, most of Americans, according to polls, have come to the conclusion that there were no WMDs, that there was no reason to go to war with Iraq.
Yeah, Robin, that's a great insight. And implicit in your question is these are not novel conclusions. What's amazing is the people that are saying them. And he says that in the end, the war turned out to be unnecessary. But they had had a suspension of disbelief. He tells a great story in this book about how Ann Compton of ABC, one of my favorite reporters, came into his office, and he was giving her the line of the day about weapons of mass destruction, saying they would still be found. And he recalls her saying, and she verified this for me, Scott, they're not going to find any. If they were going to, they would have already. And he said he momentarily felt sick, that it was like a little bit of reality that she was giving him. But he acknowledges that as soon as she walked out of the room, so did the reality.
That's Mike Allen, chief political correspondent for Politico. The new memoir by former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan is due out next week. Well, according to RealtyTrack, the number of homes entering foreclosure spiked 65% last month over the same period last year, for a total of 243,000 properties. When properties are foreclosed, vacancy is one problem, but increasingly, these properties are being filled with squatters. Sometimes these squatters are the owners or tenants who refuse to move out after a foreclosure. They're also homeless people or scam artists who figured out that once they move in, it's hard for the banks to move them out. There are some really incredible consequences, as we're going to hear from Mike Charney. He's a real estate broker from Wellesley, Massachusetts, outside of Boston. Banks hire him to deal with foreclosures. He says he encounters squatters in about 25% of the foreclosed properties he deals with. Mark, we understand just recently you had an encounter with a squatter. What happened?
I was at a property in Dorchester, Massachusetts, and similar situation to what we encounter regularly, which is we had one occupant who we knew was there who was currently under eviction, and we were sent out to do what's called an occupancy check. When we got to the property, the occupant on the second floor informed us that there was somebody on the third floor just who shows up every night.
Is this what we call a triple decker here in Boston?
Yeah.
Three units? Okay. So
it's a three-family house, triple decker. And so I said, well, who are they? He said, I don't know who they are. They just show up and they're just loud. And I said, well, how long has this been going on? 10 days. So I went upstairs, knocked on the door. Guy comes to the door. I said, excuse me, but, you know, what's going on? He goes, I don't know. I said, well, who are you renting the apartment? Did somebody rent you this place? Or how did you end up here? He's like, my friend Mike. I said, well, where's Mike? I don't know. I said, well, what's his last name? I don't know. I mean, the guy was obviously on some drug or something, in a fog, whatever. And there he was.
And there he was.
Yeah.
And now take us through this. All right, the occupant that you knew was there, is that a tenant who happened to be in a house when the building got foreclosed?
Exactly.
Who is that?
So this is a disabled veteran who was living in the house, renting from the owner. He'd been there for about 2 years. And what generally happens is when the bank foreclosed on the property, they generally would like everybody to leave the property, because in order to sell the property to a new person, they have to sell it empty.
But what is the law? If that veteran wants to stay there, can he stay there?
Well, technically, he can go to court. Sometimes they'll offer them some relocation assistance money to basically move out before a long, lengthy eviction proceeding.
That sounds kind of euphemistic.
Right.
You know, it sounds as if it's money that the banks pay so that they don't have to pay for court.
It's short money.
Right.
And the idea is to basically avoid having, you know, a long battle. And I say to people, because I offer these programs to people all the time, and I say, listen, one way or the other, the bank is going to have you move out. Because legally, it's their property, and they have acquired it without leases, and so these people are technically there without authority to be there.
Well, and, you know, one would like to think, too, that a bank might be a little bit sensitive to the idea that you have a disabled veteran who, through no fault of his own, is suddenly finding himself homeless
because
the owner foreclosed on the building. But what about the guy on the third floor? What do you do?
I mean, this is the problem. This is the squatting problem that we're talking about. These are the people that basically are either tipped off by somebody, potentially the former owner, who says, hey, I know Unit 3 and Unit 1, they're open. Go and you can crash there. In some cases, we'll board up a property with the attempt of keeping people out. But it has a reverse effect. It's now a real big billboard saying, hey, I'm available for whatever you want.
Right, I'm an empty house.
I'm an empty house,
yeah.
And nobody really cares. And so people can basically go and camp out for free.
Can you force that third floor fellow out?
No.
By law?
No. I can't go there and say, hey, you don't have a lease. We don't know who you are. You got to get out of here. As soon as somebody's in the property, the clock starts fresh. There are laws that, you know, that the banks, especially in the state of Massachusetts, that they have to adhere to. It's not like some states where eviction proceedings can happen almost, you know, in a day or two.
It's very difficult for people like you and banks to even figure out who this person is. They don't have to tell you necessarily. There's no paperwork. The owner has left. There might have been a rental set up. They could say there was, and who's to disprove it?
We see this time and time again where people know about this relocation assistance program.
The euphemism for paying someone off to move.
Another term is cash for keys. Here's the cash, here's the keys. People know about this. People talk. They figured out the system. And the system is get in the apartment, get in the house, be there when somebody from the bank comes, and say you live there. And now you qualify for cash for keys.
Right. The bank, rather than spend the money to go to court, will give you cash. And we understand it goes further, that you might get one of these scam artists out and their friend might move right in.
Absolutely.
How often do you come across owners who've been foreclosed on and who they refuse to leave?
We see that. It's not the majority. I mean, we see a pretty wide range of experiences. So some experiences will show up and it'll be the former owner there. And this person will be cleaning the property. They'll be cleaning the property, getting it ready to pass over the keys.
Breaks your heart.
Yeah, because you're like, you don't have to be doing any of this.
Yeah.
Like, you're losing your house. You don't need to spend time and energy to do this. You should just walk away, and that'll be that. Other times, we see people where they've taken everything. They've taken the outlets. They've taken the toilets. They've taken, because, you know, they think, hey, if I can't have it, you can't have it. But the point is that some of these people will fight it. You know, they'll fight the foreclosure.
And what is the law for them when they're the owners?
The law is in their favor, certainly, when you're in a property. But when you go before a judge and you say that you're the owner, the judge is going to probably be a lot less sympathetic to you than if you say you're the tenant. So these owners will try to fight the actual foreclosure proceeding. So they'll try to challenge, like, the process.
Huh.
And they can drag it out. Process can take longer than it ought to take, let's say.
And then it's worth.
Right.
Some would look at you as the new sort of real estate repo man.
Well, you know, it's funny because it's not a laughing matter, but sometimes when you go to these properties, it feels that way.
Well, we understand many of these squatters are less cynical. They may be homeless people or crashing on mattresses or people who are just using a foreclosed home as a crash pad.
Oh, yeah. It's a real problem. And I think there is a legitimate group of people, 75%. The majority of people are the ones who are caught in this squeeze where they, you know, they didn't know what was going on and now they're there.
Well, that brings us to, do you ever come across the renters that we're hearing about who have been leased these units by scam artists who got the first and last month's rent from them and they have no idea it's a foreclosed building?
Yeah, that is the worst thing, is when we show up to the property, knock on the door, inform them of the fact that the property is now being, you know, owned by a bank, and they say, what are you talking about? I just moved in a week ago.
And I gave my money.
And I gave first, last, and 1 month security deposit. I mean, it's horrible to see that because these people just gave somebody $4,000. And the person they gave it to, in 9 times out of 10, was the guy who was going down anyways.
Who was the one who was foreclosed.
Yeah, exactly.
And we understand it could be even worse. It could be someone who just heard about it, presents themselves on Craigslist as the owner of a unit they have nothing to do with, and they rent it out.
Oh, yeah. This is symptomatic of an economic situation that is getting worse.
Well, how much worse can it get? We'll hear from Mark Charney, a real estate broker from the Boston area who deals with foreclosed properties. He says many of them are often in squalid condition with no heat or electricity. But still, some of those scam artists are not just renting these homes, but selling them on Craigslist. We're also going to hear how foreclosures affect schools and kids. That's coming up in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more from Mark Charney, a Boston area real estate broker who deals with foreclosed properties. Mark, we were just talking about scam artists, but also desperate people squatting in these properties. Because you say many of these homes are in terrible condition. Describe what you find in these places.
Some of these properties that we're talking about don't have copper piping. Some other, you know, person came in and stole it before them. We're dealing with a desperate situation because the way that they're living, the conditions inside of these properties is really deplorable. I mean, these are properties that have been neglected. In a lot of cases, that's why they've gone foreclosed, because the owner who bought them didn't take care of them, wasn't able to find tenants, couldn't get the income to pay his mortgage, and lost the house. And so they're beat up properties to begin with. Houses that don't have heat, don't have electricity, have broken windows.
Well, and this is what you're coming across, but we're also reading reports of, you know, out in Los Angeles, million-dollar homes that have been foreclosed on, and the neighbors call and said, I think people are making a pornographic movie in there. You know, people moving in to even the million-dollar homes.
Well, there's no doubt that these are opportunities for people, and people that are looking to do things that aren't right are going to take advantage of this on the low end, and they're going to take advantage of it on the high end.
Have you come across that?
Well, we haven't seen people exploiting these high-end things, but we do have several properties that are million-dollar properties that have gone foreclosed. But what we're seeing on the other side is that these properties are being snatched up. People are buying these properties. So, yes, there's no doubt. There's pain on one side. There's a whole host of people that are losing their homes, and they're being basically kicked out of their houses.
And you say a backlog of inventory.
And so there's all this property. Yeah. But on the other side, there's a ton of people that are out buying these properties because they see them as opportunities.
Obviously, you've come across many who are desperate, but are you coming across some who aren't, who are just seeing an opportunity and taking advantage of it?
People that are seeing opportunities and taking advantage of them are those people that are putting ads on Craigslist, or are those people that they know that they're going to lose their house. They've gotten the notices. They haven't informed the tenants. They're still collecting rent from the people that live there, even though they're foreclosed. Those are the people that are taking advantage of the system and the uncertainty of the situation, because that's what really happens. There's a lot of information that's not being, you know, broadcast. It's not, the tenants aren't being told, hey, by the way, in 4 weeks from now, there's going to be an auction in front of your house.
Should there be a law? Should that be required?
Well, there ought to be some degree of disclosure. I mean, the tenants definitely are in the middle. I mean, they're not notified that something's going on. And if it's the landlord, is an absentee landlord, he's probably not telling them. And he's probably, or she's probably thinking, hey, I'm going to collect as much money as I can,
right,
because I'm going to go bankrupt because I'm losing this house.
And they may, as you say, they may already have gone bankrupt.
Yeah.
And they're collecting the money just for themselves. It's not going into any payment.
And it's sad because it's like one person's pulling somebody else down, you know, with them.
Mark Charney, a real estate broker from the Boston suburb of Wellesley, Massachusetts, his job is to deal with foreclosed properties, go out and deal with tenants or squatters that may still be living there. Mark, thanks so much for speaking with us about it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, the child advocacy group First Focus estimates that 2 million children will become homeless as a direct result of the subprime mortgage crisis and subsequent foreclosures. When that happens, children often move to an area outside of their current school district, which means they should switch schools, but they often don't. The Wall Street Journal reports that school systems nationwide are cracking down on out-of-district students by hiring private investigators and creating anonymous tip lines. Bill Beitler is one such investigator in the Chicago area. His business has more than doubled this year to about 7,000 cases. He joins us. And Bill, let's explain. Schools want to make sure only students who live in their district attend their schools because it's tied to funding, right?
Well, it's tied to funding, and what it does is overcrowd the schools and kind of puts a chokehold on the district.
Right, because if they can't plan for the number of kids, of course, it gets overcrowded. And we should say there's actually a federal law known as the McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act. Now, how does this protect, there's, you know, kids who are, you know, permanently homeless and kids who are foreclosed? How does it work?
Well, the permanently homeless, they can stay within that school for as long as they go to school. The children that are displaced because of foreclosure, they are considered to be homeless for the time period that the foreclosure has taken place, and they find a new place of permanent residence.
So these kids ostensibly would be able to, like, finish out the school year while the parent is foreclosed out of a home and looking for another residence.
Here in Illinois, it is required that they finish out the school year.
But you're finding that families are keeping kids in schools beyond this legally protected time. How do they do that?
Well, what they do is they still use the previous address that they lived at, and they have the mail delivered there, and they have their driver's license and ID still registered there. And they pick up the mail before the residents even arrive back at the residence.
Well, and I'm imagining, too, that some of these old addresses aren't even homes anymore. They might just be, what, lots?
Yeah, so what they do is they set up a P.O. box that when it goes off to that lot, it'll get forwarded to this P.O. box.
So this is a problem for schools, and this is your job to track these people down. But what do they say? I mean, I'm imagining it's very hard for parents to pull some kids out of schools if they've been in that school their whole life.
I would say 80% of them would just say, oh, you caught me, okay, I'll have them disenrolled. There's that 20% that, you know, will say, well, I really want my kid to continue going to school. And the district has to take a stance that, well, we can't be prejudiced to one student and say, okay, fine, you can stay in the school, and another student, no, you can't stay in the school.
That's going to be tough because these kids have had so much disruption, you know.
Yes. And what a lot of the schools have done is, due to the foreclosure rate, is they have been letting them finish out the year. They just tell them, you know, from next year, you need to enroll in the proper district.
Bill Beitler, private investigator for National Investigations in the Chicago area, talking to us about how the spike in foreclosures is affecting kids. Bill, thanks so much.
Well, I appreciate it.
And we're going to continue to follow the fallout of the subprime mortgage crisis and foreclosures and its impact on the homeless. Next week, we'll meet a woman who worked with home loans. She now lives with her two golden retrievers in her car in the upscale community of Santa Barbara, California, where the homeless are being allowed to spend the nights in parking lots. That's next week. But still ahead today, should Paul McCartney get an honorary degree? A debate over the doctorates. Also, a new debate in the conservation movement. Save the endangered animals or save the indigenous peoples? That's still ahead after the news here and now. The drive to save endangered species and create natural reserves is making refugees of the indigenous people who live in these places and often are the people who've helped create the biological diversity that environmentalists value. The number of these so-called conservation refugees is now in the millions and growing. Mark Dowie is an investigative journalist who's written several books on the environmental movement. His upcoming book is Refugees from Conservation, Global Conservation's 100-Year Misunderstanding with Native People. He joins us now. And Mark, first of all, hopscotch around the globe. And tell us a few places where this is happening.
Well, to a degree, it's happening on every continent except Antarctica. I would say the worst situations are in Africa, and second probably in India, but it's happening all in Southeast Asia, and to a lesser degree in South America, and an even lesser degree in North America and Australia. It actually started in the United States, this whole process. It started in Yosemite and Yellowstone, but it is spread around the world as a phenomenon.
Well, let's just learn more about this template that you say is, you know, being used elsewhere. You write, wildlife conservation in India, for instance, has generally emulated the early American model, which regarded forests as pristine wilderness, excluded human beings from national parks and other protected areas. You're talking about Yosemite and Yellowstone. What happened?
Well, in Yosemite, when Yosemite was targeted as a national park, there were a combined tribe of Indians, and they settled there in the summer. They were a nomadic tribe. But when they decided to create a national park there, they basically told the combined tribe to leave. And it wasn't easy getting them out, but eventually they totally evicted them. And then repeated the process in Yellowstone in a much more violent way, actually. There were seven tribes living in what is now Yellowstone National Park, and one by one they were evicted, some of them quite violently because they resisted eviction. There was one day when 300 Shoshones were killed in the process of eviction.
But killed by whom?
In that case, it was by the Army.
And you write that the Army, the government, saw these original peoples as marauders, poachers, encroachers. And that kind of thinking is picked up elsewhere in the world now.
Oh, yeah. You still hear language like that in India. And to a degree, you heard a lot of that kind of language in colonial Africa. But the Indians still talk about the Adivasi, who are the sort of rural untouchables of India. You still hear them using language like that.
Adivasi means the original people. They're the ones disproportionately moved for conservation purposes. You write the government of India is on the verge of creating the largest mass eviction for conservation purposes, creating sanctuaries all over the country to protect endangered animals like the Asiatic lion, the tiger, or the rhino.
They really are endangered. There's no question about it. And something has to be done if they're going to be saved. But I argue, and a lot of people argue, that evicting people from these areas to protect the species is not the way to do it, because the reason why the conservationists are interested in these areas at all is because the biological diversity is so high. And if there are people living there in high biological diversity, it suggests to me that they're doing something right.
You mentioned the Gujars of India. They are also threatened with eviction, but Indian authorities and many in the conservation movement say they hunt the tiger.
Well, the Gujars and the tigers in India have been living side by side in harmony for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. So if you take them out of the forest and just turn the forest over to the tiger, you're not assuring that the tiger is going to survive. because the people who are poaching tigers are not Adivasis. They're poachers who come from a long way off to sell tiger pelts and tiger penises to wackos in China who think they're going to get some kind of sexual stimulation out of them.
It's not the indigenous peoples.
No.
Well, you know, how would you do it? I want to back up and say that almost 300,000 families in India have been moved out of their ancestral homes over the years of developing the country's national parks and sanctuaries.
Well, while this has been going on, there's been a separate and contrary movement. It's more like a social movement than a conservation movement, and what they're trying to develop is what they call community conservation. And that is to combine the traditional ecological knowledge of communities with the new sciences of ecology, biology, botany, ethnobotany, etc., and create a conservation project that involves and really is owned by the people in the community. Conservation worldwide requires a social contract. We all need to be part of that contract, but the social contract that involves indigenous people might be very, very slight change in their life ways. Maybe they should stop harvesting certain hardwoods to make a living and let the hardwoods grow and find a different way to make a living, maybe the products of the hardwoods.
Well, and I'm wondering, you know, are you sympathetic to, I mean, it's kind of, this is kind of a counterintuitive conversation, you know, because, you know, the rallying cry was save the lion, you know, save the land, save the wood. And I'm not sure many people realize that in, you know, saving and conserving, indigenous people would be moving. But, you know, do you have some sympathy for the movement to try to save a disappearing lion, a disappearing beast, or a disappearing hardwood?
Absolutely. This is a good guy story.
Yeah.
And it is. I mean, and conservationists have their heart and their mission in the right place. I just think they're making a fundamental mistake and have made a fundamental mistake historically in evicting people in the interests of conservation. And I think now probably half the conservationists in the world agree with me. And I'm trying to get the other half to agree with me. because I think I don't think it's just bad for people to be evicted, and it's not just a social injustice. It's bad for conservation. It's bad for biological diversity to do this, because people lose respect for the land that they love if they're removed from the land, and they'll turn around and abuse it, and it's happening all over the world.
Well, what do indigenous peoples that are moved out of conservation land, what do they get in return?
They're often offered compensation, and sometimes they get it, or sometimes they get part of what they're offered and promised, but they never get enough compensation to compensate for the fact that they've lost their livelihood and lost their homeland. I mean, try to imagine if someone said to you, you know, we're going to take your house away, but you're going to compensate, and they're going to give you the assessed value of your house. That doesn't account for the fact that that was your home, right?
Right.
And so to take a homeland away is very difficult to assuage with compensation.
Do you see people's, you know, rising up against a government that's, you know, taking...
Oh, absolutely. Oh, no, absolutely. The whole indigenous movement of the world, which is a vast, vast movement involving millions of people, have now embraced several declarations that have said the extractive industries used to be our biggest enemies because they would come in and build dams and cut down our forests and spill oil all over the place and say, well, now we have a new enemy, and the new enemy is conservation. We were the original conservationists, and now you've come in and made us enemies of conservation.
That's Mark Dowie, investigative journalist. He's written several books on the environmental movement. His upcoming book is Refugees from Conservation, Global Conservation's 100-Year Misunderstanding with Native People. Mark, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, when a top doctor at the Veterans Administration heard about the high number of troop suicides, he wrote in an email, shh. Well, we're going to meet a father who doesn't want to hush up his son's suicide. In fact, he's suing the VA. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. It's graduation season, universities and colleges handing out degrees to students and doctorates to dignitaries and Kermit the Frog. It's fun for the graduates and good for fundraising and prestige for the schools. but it's also a sign of the fall of Western civilization, according to our next guest. Essayist Joseph Epstein joins us. I was paraphrasing, but you write in the Weekly Standard, a cultural historian may one day be able to measure the fall of seriousness of American universities by tracking the people to whom they chose to award an honorary degree.
Absolutely. The great sweep of these matters has fallen from Joseph Haydn being offered an honorary degree by the University of Oxford in 1792 to Paul McCartney being offered an honorary degree at Yale this spring.
And your problem with that is what?
Well, my problem with it is I think that though I like Paul McCartney's music, I myself have passed 64 and people are still feeding me and things like that. But it's not of the same kind of gravity and seriousness which universities are supposed to have stood for.
Well, let me just hold you up there and ask. Sure, there are plenty of celebrities to be found in this year's crop of doctorates. But there's also Philip Sharp, Nobel Prize winner, speaking to the Elbury School of Science at Penn State. There's Eric Lander, who's getting a Doctor of Science at Columbia. He's the founding director of the Broad Institute. That's the disease prevention research organization at MIT. In other words, sure, there's a percentage of the celebrities who are usually speaking to schools of music, but there's still the scientists and the important people.
That's absolutely true. There's a mixture, but I wonder why the university feels the need for the mixture. Northwestern, where I teach, gave an honorary degree 2 years ago, I think, to Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Now, I happen to think Julia Louis-Dreyfus is a terrific comedian.
She, of course, of Seinfeld fame.
Right, but I don't think an honorary degree is quite the way to recognize this, for a very lightweight person.
Why do you think they're doing it?
Well, I think they're doing it for a couple of reasons. Publicity, number one. Number two, they're getting a very inexpensive commencement address. If you tried to get Julia Louis-Dreyfus to speak to an industrial concern, she would charge $150,000 or something. And it also gives students the delight of saying, gee, we had this wonderful, world-famous person, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and she was so funny and she was so amusing. It may be that university commencement addresses should be staggeringly boring. I don't know. But I don't think they're under the obligation to be like a television show. I see I'm coming off as a great stiffo here.
Yeah, you are.
There it is. I hadn't realized I was quite this starchy.
Well, you also mentioned, and I'm sure there are some people who agree with you, but you also mentioned the pitfalls of doctorates because you talk about Northwestern's offer to Reverend Jeremiah Wright. He was scheduled to be awarded a doctorate by Northwestern,
correct,
but it had to be rescinded after his controversial remarks.
Exactly. Well, I think one of the other obligations is that honorary degrees are given under a kind of affirmative action, or diversity is really the word, principle. That is to say, you dare not give a set of honorary degrees where one doesn't go to an African-American, to an Asian American, to a woman, and so forth and so on.
Well, I
suppose the argument here was, what's wrong with that?
Well, yeah, because, for instance, I'm looking at the history of Harvard's doctorates, and I would say that going back to 1753,
they're all men, I'm sure.
They're pretty much men, and they're pretty much white.
Yeah, I'm sure that's absolutely true. You see, in a case like Jeremiah Wright, I think what Northwestern was doing was searching out an African American.
Well, no, he had national prestige. He was considered one of the top pastors in the country. His comments are still being debated as to what they meant. He had quite a reputation prior to this recent blow-up.
I guess what I would like is a kind of colorblind, genderblind,
celebrity blind?
Celebrity blind above all, I think. Just give those degrees to those people who are utterly deserving and, it's insofar as it's possible, unequivocally deserving. In my article, I mentioned that the University of Chicago has limited itself to just giving honorary degrees to scholars, scientists, and artists.
Well, that would leave you out.
Yes, it would, and I could live with that.
And we should say, full disclosure, you have one from a small school.
Yes, you have one also?
I have one from a small school.
Well, had I known this, we're talking doc to doc here.
That's Dr. and essayist Joseph Epstein. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Not at all. Take care.
And in 1 minute, your thoughts here and now. Here are are a few of your recent thoughts. We spoke with author Gail Green, an insomniac whose book of the same title takes the sleep industry to task for, among other things, treating insomnia as a symptom of something else rather than a disorder in and of itself. Well, Andrew Borson of the Crozer Sleep Disorder Center at Taylor Hospital in Ridley Park, Pennsylvania, also a fellow of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, couldn't let that charge go by. He writes, one of the big problems that most insomniacs have is the fear that their sleep problem will destroy their health and shorten their lives. In my experience, the fear of what insomnia will do is one of the factors that keeps insomnia occurring, much like some other anxiety disorders. There are some medical and circadian rhythm reasons as to why insomnia may start that are not linked to anxiety, but typically, in my opinion, it continues for anxiety reasons. Staying with health, Dr. Timothy Johnson, commenting on the recent measles outbreak in the U.S., said he felt it was dangerous for parents not to immunize their kids. Well, Charlie Summers of York, Pennsylvania, disagreed with Dr. Johnson. He writes, as a 50-something who contracted all of the childhood diseases and so has natural and permanent immunity, unlike the temporary immunities provided through vaccinations, I think we're being a bit silly immunizing against everything. Polio is one thing, but chickenpox? It's no wonder that kids we're raising today are so susceptible to things we thought of as a normal part of growing up. We're making our children's immune systems weak and incapable of dealing with simple viral attacks, all in the name of pharmaceutical profits and the convenience of not having to take off a few days from work to care for them. Alana Newhouse was on the program recently. She told a story of turning to a Hebrew traveler's prayer while flying before realizing that turning to another passenger and holding hands during a rough patch was actually what the prayer was instructing her to do. Well, that prompted Carolyn Alport of Carefree Arizona to call about a not-so-carefree flight.
I've had that same experience of sitting next to someone and holding hands during a particularly bad time, once with a cadet in the Air Force who I thought probably wouldn't be scared, but was.
And finally, Karen Van Kennen asked about the version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game that we played recently. It was from Carly Simon's CD, Clouds in My Coffee, 1965-1995.
'Cause it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
Let us hear from you at letters@here-now.org or give us a call at 617-358-0397. The Mall in Washington, D.C., Karl Marx plots in Leipzig, Beijing's Tiananmen Square, these places are etched in memory in part because of the protests that took place there. Just how do rallies and marches work? Who decides the route, the signs, the songs? Here Now's Ken Shulman visited an exhibit at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology to find out.
Whether it's voters demanding democracy in Kiev or mothers defying dictators in Buenos Aires, all protests share one vital element. They're meticulously planned. Tali Hatuka is an Israeli architect and urban designer who studies the dynamic of civil protest.
We have to think about them as a really crafted event that takes into consideration the space, the monuments, the movement, the form, the voices that are going to be displayed in the protest. So it's impossible to think about it anymore as a spontaneous kind of informal thing.
Over the past 3 years, Hatuka trekked from Indianapolis to Istanbul, analyzing decades of demonstrations. Her videos, photographs, and models are on display at the Compton Gallery at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Protest, the exhibit suggests, is political theater, and some of them are blockbusters. In this massive 2002 labor strike, demonstrators occupied the main highway in downtown Caracas and forced Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez out of office for 4 days. A delicate balance between body, sound, and space, protest is also a balance between dissent and power. And when that balance breaks down, things can turn deadly. Yeah. Hundreds, perhaps thousands of protesters were killed when the Chinese military intervened during these June 1989 demonstrations in Beijing's Tiananmen Square.
The agreed, accepted route and plan of the events is a crucial thing for the government of the regime, because this is what symbolized them, the stability, the limitation, the boundaries of the event itself. So when these boundaries are challenged, violence usually comes into play.
Protest theory states that large venues require large castes. Small groups tend to be gobbled up, but sometimes small is big. During the Argentine dictatorship of the 1970s and 80s, mothers whose children had been abducted by the military marched every day in groups of two or three, holding photos of their missing sons and daughters. Their venue? Buenos Aires' massive Plaza de Mayo. The stark contrast between maternal will and military might was broadcast around the world. Estela Barnes de Carlota was active in these protests.
La Plaza de Mayo fue el lugar de concentración.
The Plaza de Mayo was the natural focal point of the city, and it was the seat of the government. The people who kidnapped our children were there. The people who needed to give us answers were there.
In the internet, today's activists have an even more powerful tool. This spring, students used the web to organize small protests nationwide against prisoner abuse at the U.S. Detention Center in Guantanamo Bay. At Harvard, law students donned orange jumpsuits and black hoods and sat at the feet of the John Harvard statue in Harvard Yard. Perhaps 100 people saw it in person, but hundreds of thousands watched it online. Law student Thomas Becker says protest and cyberspace have become inseparable.
I think first, most of us don't have access to, you know, Congress. We don't get to discuss these things, and I think in some ways it's the only option for a lot of us. But I also think it serves as an important tool to mobilize other people. When you see people on the ground involved and stuff, they want to get involved because they also know that they're not going to have access to, you know, the Congress floor.
If the MIT show has a takeaway, it's that protest is an art and not a science. For every Plaza de Mayo, there are dozens of marches that are crushed, and even more that pass unnoticed. Yet the rallies continue in places like Ramallah, Johannesburg, and Manchester, anywhere where people have the need and means to tell their stories. For Tali Hatuka, the spectacle we call protest is a profoundly human drama.
In contemporary society, where we mainly cultivate our individual careers, homes, protest gives us a sense of community and a sense of a shared narrative, a sense of being together. And I think this situation with the anxiety that usually accompany protest is something very, very strong.
Howdy, howdy.